chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir. And folks dressed up like Eskimos. Yep. Nose. A turkey and some mistletoe will help to bright tiny finally hard to sleep tonight. They know that
Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And as the voice and festive cough of the inimitable JJ Jones fades away, who we'll return to later on, let me introduce today's programme, which is going to be slightly different from usual because as it is now just about a year since the Mind Renewed launched on iTunes, and since we're now almost at the end of 2013, I thought it would be a good idea to indulge in, you probably know what I'm going to say, a retrospective, which also serves as an introduction, of course, because I know there are new listeners finding us all the time. And if you are one of those new listeners, then let me say welcome to the Mind Renewed. I hope you find that this gives you a good idea of what we do here. And it's going to take the form of looking back at just some of the interviews that we've had here since we began in 2012. Now, when I started all this back in June of that year, I hadn't really got a clue about podcasting or running a website or USB microphones and all the other bits and pieces that go into making this happen. But with the encouragement of people like James Corbett, particularly with his insistence that anybody can do this kind of thing, I thought to myself, well, I'm anybody, so I can do this kind of thing. And I plucked up courage and started the website. And of course, I was then faced with the problem of who I was going to have for the first interview. Now, I knew that 9/11 was one of the issues that I wanted to cover, so I simply contacted the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, and I asked if they knew of anybody who'd be prepared to come on and talk about the subject of 9/11 and people of faith. And to my amazement, none other than Dr. Kevin Barrett replied, saying that he'd be happy to come on. And what was so amazing about this was that at the time, there was nothing on the website, so it really was very good of him to come on, and he gave an excellent interview and really gave me an easy introduction to the whole business of conducting interviews. So I'm going to start there. Let's hear a section where I ask him about the difficulty that many people have in believing that 9/11 could even possibly have been some kind of inside job. Now, there are many people, of course, who have difficulty believing that a faction within the American government could have been involved in planning and executing an atrocity like this. And they would raise the question as to what possible motive they could have had for killing American citizens. I mean, you know, surely the government's there to protect its people, isn't it? So how would you respond to that?
Well, there are a couple of ways. The first would be to say that anyone who thinks that a coup d'etat could happen in somebody else's country is, you know, like these who say, that only happens to other people. You know, that's called denial. A coup d'etat is one of the most common occurrences in any country. You know, there's no country that is immune to coups d'etat. The U.S. has had many, many coups, and they're all, you know, kept under wraps by the mainstream media. We had the murders of the Kennedy brothers, which were both essentially coups d'etat. We had the October surprise, in which Carter was taken out of the White House and Reagan and Bush were inserted into the White House by a covert operation to keep the American hostages locked up in Iran until Reagan was inaugurated. And in fact, they were kept up. They were released, actually, just, I think, 2 to 3 minutes after Reagan took the oath of office, which is a little too obvious. There's a long history of these coups. In the 30s, there's the Smedley-Butler coup d'etat, in which the wealthiest Americans approached the Marine hero General Smedley Butler and said, "We're going to make you the American Hitler." And Butler, you know, listened to them, got all the information on their coup d'etat plans, and then went to Congress and spilled the beans. And it showed just, you know, how powerful these private interests are. Congress didn't go after them. You know, it entered all the material on the record. So no historian today doubts that there was indeed a planned coup d'etat in which America's wealthiest citizens planned to make Smedley Butler the American Hitler. And it only failed because Smedley Butler was too honest. This is not in dispute, but hardly anyone even knows about it because it's all been covered up by our mainstream media and mainstream historiography. So a coup d'etat is just a very common thing. Every country has them all the time. and it's not just South American generalissimos that lead coups d'etat. So that's one answer. The second answer is that the idea of a false flag attack in which strategists allow their own people to be killed in order to trigger an advantage in the coming war is a very, very common scenario throughout history. The British Empire was built on such a false flag attack, the Guy Fawkes event. Guy Fawkes was just a hapless patsy who was maneuvered into being placed beneath Parliament with a bunch of wet gunpowder that could never possibly go off. And then he was arrested, and England was saturated with messages from the pulpits, and especially that there was an evil Catholic plot to kill everybody in Parliament. And so that led to the wars against Spain and Portugal. And this was a false flag operation by the War Party at the time, led by Robert Cecil. And today in the USA, U.S. history is nothing, you know, the history of our wars in the USA is almost nothing but a history of these false flag events. A fake Mexican attack was engineered to launch the Mexican War of 1847. The USS Maine was blown up in Havana Harbor, killing a couple hundred Americans to launch the war against Spain, Spanish-American War. The Lusitania was sent into a fleet of German U-boats, and passengers were murdered by the U-boats. But, you know, it was orchestrated by those who wanted to bring the U.S. into World War I. Pearl Harbor was orchestrated by an 8-point plan to get the Japanese to attack first. And the Americans and Churchill knew exactly where it was coming, and they left 2,000 sailors to be murdered to enrage the American people and drag the U.S. into World War II. Prior to Pearl Harbor, 80% of Americans opposed joining World War II. Vietnam was launched by a non-existent Gulf of Tonkin North Vietnamese attack that never happened. That was just a theatrical event, a false flag, and so on and so forth. So if indeed 9/11 were an actual foreign terrorist attack, and not a false flag event, it would be essentially the first time in American history that the U.S. had gone to war based on an actual foreign attack that wasn't orchestrated by our own side. And this sounds terrible, but it makes perfect strategic sense because the U.S. has always been the most powerful party in all of these engagements. And no less powerful party ever attacks a more powerful party if they can possibly help it. And yet, human nature is such that people won't go to war except to defend their country. Nobody wants to go to war as an aggressor. So if you're a powerful country, you have a strategic motive to go to war because you can win the war. You can steal resources. You can gain more control and more power. And the problem is that your people don't want to do it because they don't like aggressive war. So how do you get them to go to war? You have to stage a fake enemy attack. And this happens over and over and over throughout history. It's how almost all wars start.
Now, Kevin Barrett's comments there about false flag attacks and how common they really are came just 6 months or so before there was, in fact, a huge surge in people's interest in the subject. You may remember that back in April 2013, Washington's blog reported that the number of searches on Google for phrases like false flag attack or Operation False Flag were then at an all-time high, I guess because of questions surrounding the Boston bombing, which certainly does suggest that there is a growing awareness that governments around the world do, in fact, engage in this kind of lying and murderous activity to further agendas which would otherwise be unacceptable to their population. So I think there is great hope that more and more people are becoming aware that this is really going on. And as we're on that subject, let me recommend a conversation I had with Kurt Haskell, who was a witness to the so-called underwear bomber incident in 2009, which he considers to have been precisely a false flag staged event. And I'm not going to play a section from that particular interview, but I do encourage you to go and listen to that because it was a fascinating interview. But as to 9/11 being a coup d'etat, I put this to Dr. Niels Harrit, whose team of scientists had identified the presence of nanothermite, the incendiary or explosive material, nanothermite in the dust from the World Trade Center towers, and I asked him if he thought that 9/11 should be considered a coup d'etat. And he raised the stakes. In his view, 9/11 was a coup de monde.
The only conspiracy theory that we are involved in is the one with Osama bin Laden, the 19 hijackers, and Al-Qaeda. It was a conspiracy because, according to the official version of events, they conspired to commit a crime. And it is a theory because so far we have seen no single piece of solid forensic evidence that the official conspiracy theory is correct. Which means that we have been brought not only into three wars, or even more probably, and I'm counting Afghanistan, Iraq, and the war against terror. Other people will add to that list what is happening recently now in the Middle East. Not only are we brought into war, but the whole global society is going down the drain. We are talking about our civilization, which is in the balance at stake now, no less. And in my opinion, the most important corroding factor is the lie. Everybody is scared and everybody is lying, and that is accepted. We simply cannot survive that state of lies and fears. And that is the main reason, in my opinion, why not only we enter wars, but that the economy is going so badly. And it all is converging into what happened on September 11th, 2001. And I'm very, very serious, and I'm talking now on behalf of my grandchildren. We cannot survive and maintain the society we have without confronting the events of September 11th, 2001. And it is getting late.
I had an interview with Kevin Barrett. He said that he understood 9/11 to be a coup d'etat, that a faction within the American establishment essentially, I presume this is what he meant, took over that day in a very strange way, but nevertheless took over, and that we are living with the results of that coup d'etat. Now, do you understand it in that way?
Well, I would say coup de monde. It is not a state coup. It's a global coup. And I think that to talk about a specific country, I think is not correct. Every attempt to rationalize this conflict along national, ethnic, or religious fractures is a digression, a derailment. I'm not pointing any fingers. I do not know who actually instituted 9/11. We do not know. But we can feel that there are somebody in charge which are beyond the national level, beyond national laws, and can apparently do anything without being concerned. So I would rather say that it's a coup against our global community, because we are all connected now, and when we go, we'll go together.
Now, that notion of coup de monde brings me to another subject that we've been considering on the program, probably, I think, more than any other, and that is the subject of the New World Order, as befits our subtitle, Thinking Christianly in a New World Order. So we started a series of interviews back in January this year called Does Anybody Really Believe in World Government? And I mentioned that title, actually, to Eric Karlstrom, who came on the program, and he laughed as if to say, of course, there are lots of people who believe in world government. And again, much to my delight and my privilege, a number of very knowledgeable and well-known guests agreed to come on. Dean Gotcher, James Corbett, Dr. Martin Erdman, Dr. Stanley Monteith, Tony Gosling, Michael Shaw, Nikki Rapana. And one of the things that's amazed me about speaking to these people is the way that much of what they've had to say mutually coheres. And, you know, I hadn't designed it that way. I didn't choose these guests because I thought they'd all generally agree with each other. It just seems to have turned out that way, which, in my view, does lend credence to the view that there really is, both in secret and quite openly, a push towards world government. And among the questions I wanted to ask was, should we see this evident push towards world government as, in some sense, a unified action by apparently disparate players on the world stage, is it unified in some way? And if that's the case, how might we understand that? So I put that question to James Corbett.
Let's consider the two main areas in which a push towards New World Order can be most clearly seen, at least it seems to me anyway. So first of all, we have the US-NATO expansionism, which many people would see as a kind of corporate fascist expansionism and making way for Western-style corporate industrial domination. So let's say, just for the sake of it, to call that, let's label that right wing, because I think a lot of people would see it that way. And then on the other hand, we have clearly a move towards a New World Order through the Earth Charter, Agenda 21, climate change agenda. I know that's the case because Lord Monckton made it very clear at one of the UN climate change conferences that the world government was in view there. I think it appeared in one of the draft treaties. And these, it's often claimed, have to do with the destruction of industrial nations, the redistribution of wealth between nations, as it says in the Earth Charter. So we could label that as a kind of left wing, say a globalist kind of left wing. So the question is here, do these ultimately represent different elites behind these moves? Or could we be seeing a kind of 21st century manifestation of what Anthony Sutton believed was happening in the 20th century, which you were referring to, I think, a few minutes ago, that the same inner circle of collectivists were behind the financing of both Nazi Germany and communist Russia? Do we have, in the modern era, a kind of globalist right wing and a globalist left wing, both ultimately being manipulated by the same elite?
I would say so, but it's not necessarily as definitive as that. I think there may be overlap between various factions of what is, again, a group of individuals who are united by an ideology, the ideology being ultimately, I think, the establishment of that world government. But there are different paths towards the establishment of that world government. So this might be easiest to, I think, exemplify in a specific example. So, for example, within the United States political context, you have people like, for example, Henry Kissinger, who has traditionally been associated with the right side of the left-right political spectrum. He's served many Republican administrations, and he represents, I think, broadly speaking, that I suppose the global domination by force type of idea of the NATO-US expansionism, etc., that path towards some sort of world order at the end of a barrel of a gun. Broadly speaking, I wouldn't want to simplify it to that degree, but I think that broadly we could say that that's the side of the argument that someone like Henry Kissinger would come on. Another person who I think would be the mirror image of that and coming from more of the left side of that spectrum would be someone like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, again, has had enormous influence, certainly a number of Democratic administrations, most notably in the Jimmy Carter administration, where he was national security advisor. And I would say that his strategy might represent a more palatable idea of world governance and world dominance by the left side of that political spectrum, whereby it's not necessarily direct confrontation and bombing countries to smithereens directly, but more like playing different sides off against each other from a distance and being sort of the innocent bystander on the side. Yeah. And I think that's one example of how there can be two different aspects, two different ideas, two different frameworks for accomplishing the same thing. And I don't necessarily believe that someone like Kissinger and Brzezinski are mortal enemies. I think they're connected by a number of organizations to which they both belong. For example, Henry Kissinger, part of that Bilderberg steering committee, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, a former Bilderberg attendee. So again, they are connected to some of these organizations, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have the same idea of how to arrive at the world order, or even necessarily that they have the exact same idea of what that world order would look like or who would be involved in it. But at the end of the day, I think, of course, they have more in common with each other than they would with you or I or most of the people listening to this podcast, for example. So I think that we can look at it in those terms. It's not necessarily that these are the same people in the sense that they are identical. It's not necessarily that they are mortally opposed to each other. It's more, I would say, that they have a similar aim, but they have different methods for getting there. And I think that each side of that fight, assuming there are only two sides, there might be a number of different factions, but each side in that struggle wants to become the dominant one that will use their way to get to proceed forward. And in some ways, I think you could make the argument that at the very least, that sort of right wing idea of the expansionist philosophy and the left wing idea of the UN Earth Charter, the climate change agenda, all of that need each other in order to become even more effective, when you can have two sides that play off against each other and seem like the only two options that are possible, it's easier to steer people into that debate in a way that they don't even understand they're choosing sides in a false choice that's been presented to them. So it can make it look like that there are actually two different agendas on the table, when in fact, at the end of the day, they lead towards the same idea.
And one of the places in which the coherence that I was talking about showed itself most clearly was in the conversation I had with Michael Shaw, the president of Freedom Advocates, because what he had to say about the United Nations program Agenda 21 very neatly drew together a number of issues that we'd been exploring on the program: world government, technocracy, the smart grid, climate change, population reduction. And Michael Shaw's message was really very clear. Agenda 21 is essentially a vision for technocratic world government. The smart grid is about building an infrastructure of control, and the issues of climate change and population reduction are essentially levers to persuade the populations of the world to go along with this agenda. So let's hear a couple of sections in which he explains first how Agenda 21 is being implemented, for example, through an NGO called ICLEI, and secondly, how the smart grid fits into that picture.
Well, ICLEI is an international NGO. NGO means non-governmental organization. An NGO is accredited by the United Nations for purposes of implementing Agenda 21. Well, there are many, many thousands of NGOs operating in the United States today. One of them is ICLEI. Now, ICLEI is based in Bonn, Germany. It has regional offices on every inhabited continent of the world. What their objective is to create independent city-states. The city-state is the idea that is the core of the creation of world government. So what ICLEI has done is it's come all around the world. I'll focus on the United States for a few moments here. In the United States, it has over 600 cities and counties who are dues-paying members to ICLEI. Now, the founder of ICLEI has given speeches, and some of their other leaders have given speeches around the world, saying that the United Nations, with whom ICLEI works very closely, in fact, they wrote the local Agenda 21 program, which is in distribution in cities around the world. But the ICLEI leaders have said that the United Nations will ultimately become the United Cities of the world. And so ICLEI's purpose is to come in, and here in the United States, their present focus is to work with cities on developing climate change mitigation dynamics. Well, climate change is really just the cover for claiming the sky is falling. We have a worldwide crisis. We need a worldwide response. And to do that, we need a worldwide one government. So ICLEI comes in and changes city statutes so that land use can reflect the objectives of global warming mitigation. You say, well, how does that work? Well, that works in part by supporting the Agenda 21 program of smart growth development, which means stacking and packing human beings in dense human settlements and ridding the countryside of those nasty humans. And that's a process you certainly see happening in Great Britain. So ICLEI is the bane of people who believe in national sovereignty. ICLEI has been extraordinarily successful in its efforts, notwithstanding that here in the United States, in our Constitution, in our federal Constitution, there's a prohibition from any state or its subdivision, a city or a county, from associating through any treaty, alliance, or confederation with a foreign political power. Well, that's what ICLEI is. It's an agent of the UN based in Bonn, Germany, whose objective it is to pull out metropolises from the United States, take them out from under their state government, and put them into an international combine that works to the ends of a world order.
There's one thing that I think will be particularly interesting to my listeners was we've been talking recently to Martin Erdmann about the smart grid and a number of the things that you were saying about this smart growth, I thought immediately connected with the implementation of the smart grid. And you also mentioned the involvement of Silicon Valley. Do you think that this is all hand in hand with the same process of introducing this kind of technocratic order through the smart grid and smart growth? Is it all one process, do you think?
Yes.
without equivocation. The smart grid is what gives government, you think back to 1984, the two-way TV, you know, you can watch TV and the TV can watch you. You know, we are in that realm today, and the smart grid is about doing that. It's so that the government knows how much electricity you're using, so the government knows if you've got two refrigerators and they can turn one of them off. It's about total management and control, you know, which is one of the indicia of the Agenda 21 objective. They want to manage and control all human action, and that's why things like biometrics have become so key, because these cameras are all equipped with the ability to biometrically search any individual and tie that individual to whatever databases they have. And they do that by examining the biometrics of your face, which driver's licenses in this country are increasingly going to biometric pictures of you to get a driver's license. So now those 300 pictures a day taken of you in London or in San Francisco, it doesn't matter because it's all an international scheme, can identify you and everything you thought was private with the click of a computer button. And so the smart grid, which makes so much more control possible, they can turn down your heat, they can turn down your air conditioning, they can shut off your refrigerator. They can do most anything they want through the technology that is advanced through the smart grid.
And I want to continue for a moment with this theme of coherence, because it comes out yet again in the interviews with Dr. Tim Ball, the Canadian climatologist who most definitely is not part of that so-called consensus on human-produced climate change. And when I asked him if he saw a connection between the ideology of human population reduction and the issue of climate change, well, he responded with a resounding yes. And what's even more interesting is that he put it yet again, in the context of world government.
Yes.
Do you feel that this agenda is actually part of the drive behind the theory of anthropogenic global warming?
It's the total drive. The overpopulation, they keep going back to it. It's what I call daylight robbery. It's like with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that they just came out with. The summary for policymakers tells you one thing. The science report tells you that nothing that they're saying in the summary can possibly be true because we don't have the science for it. But they know that nobody's going to read the science report, and they release the science report after they've put out the summary, as they did, as you know, on Friday and Saturday. It's this deception. And in 1994, they organized a world population conference in Cairo, Egypt. It was the first one. And who was instrumental behind that? Paul Ehrlich, Al Gore. Al Gore was the leader of the U.S. delegation and was a keynote speaker at that conference. And of course, it came out of the 1992 Rio conference, which is where all of these ideas were incorporated into a global political agenda. The key thing, Julian, in all of these issues is it's all about total world control. And of course, you need, therefore, issues that supposedly transcend the ability of local or national governments to cope with them. If you say the sky is falling and the climate is the end, that's nothing that any one government can deal with. Therefore, we need international government. So put us in charge of it and don't hold us accountable for any of it. And we'll save you from the sky is falling.
Now, of course, these aren't the only subjects we've been looking at over the last year or so. We've also had interviews on health issues, on aspartame with Cory Brackett, on BPA with Dr. Frederick von Saal. We've had interviews on, well, for want of a better name, government duplicity with Mike Kenner on the UK Ministry of Defence's secret biological warfare spraying programme, with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts on Syria and on the NSA and on the Osama bin Laden assassination hoax and its aftermath. And that's actually what I want to play an excerpt from, because part of that conversation had to do with the extremely suspicious deaths of SEAL Team 6 members just 3 months after that alleged assassination. And what Dr. Roberts had to say was, well, to put it mildly, rather sobering. Could we move on to talk a little bit about the matter of the SEAL Team 6 tragedy that happened in August of the 2011? Now, I understand that there's a legal case that's being pursued by some of the families of the members of that team that died. As many listeners will remember, a large number of Navy SEALs from Team 6 were killed. It was just 3 months after that claimed raid when the helicopter they were traveling in Afghanistan was shot down by the Taliban on August the 6th, 2011. Now, when this story first broke, I think there was a kind of sense of disbelief that so very many people from that team had allegedly assassinated bin Laden had been killed in this way. And since then, some of the families of these fallen SEALs have investigated the circumstances surrounding this shootdown, and they found many, many disturbing issues that need to be answered. So could I ask you to give us some idea of what their concerns are about what happened?
Well, I've not investigated this. But I did watch an interview with the father and mother of one of these SEALs. And I did read a report on what other of the families were saying and what had got them aware and alarmed. What they said was that when they first read the government's account, it was fine. They didn't think much about it. And they were just sorry to have lost their sons. But that the second time they read it, they got some questions, and then the third time they started seeing that it didn't make a whole lot of sense. So they played the role in the SEAL affair that the 9/11 families played in the 9/11 investigation. You may remember the White House right after 9/11 said there'll be no investigation, and the families of the survivors fought for a year demanding. And of course, they never got an investigation, but they did get the commission, which sort of covered it all up. And so the White House had to deliver the commission just to get the families to. And yet some of the families are still going on about it. So the SEAL families now are playing the same role. They're saying, look, why was the entire unit put on a 50-year-old Vietnam helicopter? Where'd you get the helicopter from? Out of a museum? These aren't the modern attack helicopters that the SEALs operate in. It dispersed. You never put the whole unit. You've got a 50-year-old Vietnam helicopter with no fire suppression capability.
This is a Chinook, is that right? Designed in the 1960s.
Yeah, it's a 60s thing. And these are expensively trained troops. I think I read it cost $1 million to train one SEAL. Mm. And you stick them all on there together and send them into a combat fire zone? This is just some of the incongruities about the situation that the families brought up. Other families said that their sons had expressed a great deal of unease, had been very uneasy recently. One father said his son made a will. Others were sending messages home that they were concerned about the safety, and they weren't talking about the enemy.
And I believe that there were 7 Afghan commandos who were just sort of switched over at the last minute, and there's no answer to that either.
There's no answer to that either. See, since I never believe the raid story because it's implausible in every aspect, when I saw the report that the SEALs had been killed, all the whole unit, the White House quickly said, except for those SEALs that got bin Laden, they somehow weren't on that helicopter. Well, that seems strange, too, to me. I mean, why quickly say that? I think what happened, there weren't any SEALs sent to Abbottabad, and the SEALs were doing the same thing that the sailors on the ship were doing initially, saying, did you see the burial? What burial? Did you see it? And the SEALs were saying, were you on that mission? Who was on the mission? And nobody was on the mission. And the next step would be they would be riding home. Well, we don't know about this. None of us were there. And so they shut them up. I can't prove that. I'm not even asserting it. But I am saying it makes the most sense. It does tie the whole thing together in a way that makes sense of it. You see, why would you put, if the SEALs are going into combat, why put them on a 50-year-old helicopter that can't deflect enemy fire, unless you want them dead? Why would you want such a crack heroic team dead?
We've also had a series of interviews looking at new religious movements, the Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Scientology, the New Age, and distortions within Christianity itself, such as the Word Faith movement and the phenomenon of the charlatan televangelist. And on that subject, I was privileged to speak to Ole Anthony, founder and president of the Trinity Foundation, who's worked for decades to expose false and harmful teachers in the religious broadcasting industry. And during the conversation, he told me what it was that first prompted him to start that work.
The whole idea of the success theology, or the word faith ministries and all those, it's sorcery. It's like going to the worst, crookedest gambling hall in Las Vegas and playing the slot machines. And they're just lying to people. I mean, they're outright lies. And this is the thing that gets me. Well, let me tell you the first what lit my fire. We did a video making fun of, I mean, I was on a program that made fun of Robert Tilton, who was prominent a few years ago. And I got a phone call after that from a woman. She had a 13-year-old daughter that had multiple sclerosis. And she had watched this pre-produced testimonial say that a woman they had on the show had given Tilton a $1,000 seed faith. They made a vow of faith. And when it was paid, she was healed. Well, obviously, it was just a lie, but here's what happened. This girl secretly sent, she made the $1,000 vow of faith, 13-year-old girl. Her grandmother gave her most of the money. But at the end of the 12 months, which was the time that she was supposed to be healed, she called this man of God, and whoever answered said, when she was told, why am I not healed? In fact, I'm much worse than I was. And this phone minister said, well, it's because you have secret sin in your life.
Oh, I say.
Now, this little girl, and if you've been around teenage girls or young girls that age, they're very conscious of self in every way, especially one with multiple sclerosis. She went out in the backyard and committed suicide because...
That's absolutely appalling, yes.
I mean, it's the thing that lit the fire under me. Now, there are many cases since then where people have died, you know, just by their natural causes, but that one is the one that burned my bacon, as we say.
Indeed.
I mean, there's so much of this going on. It's sickening, and it's getting worse.
And I think one of the things which first, well, sort of grabbed my attention with this whole issue was, you know, you can think about these people who are really badly affected by it, as we've just been discussing, but there's also the effect that it has on people who are non-believers who are looking on, you know, at these TV shows, and they see the evangelist, the so-called evangelist up there, and they think to themselves, well, they must think to themselves, well, this is what Christianity is. And then think, well, I don't want anything to do with that. There must be people who are put off Christ by what they see.
Oh, yeah. I've been appalled by this, the same thing that you just described, since we started. And one day I was praying, and I just said, God, what would you say to these people that have been turned away from God? Now, the day that I was saying that, I was on Diane Sawyer's program. She was interviewing me. And so Diane said, what would you say to the people that we just talked about? And I said, Diane, I don't think you're asking for the people, and I don't think you're asking, what would I say? The question is, what would God say to you? And then you want to hear what came out? I just came out. I'm talking to Diane Sawyer, which is just crazy. So stubborn and rebellious child, has my love no longer the power to melt your heart? Have you been driven away by those who claim to know me, but were filled with hypocrisy and greed and drunk with the stench of a death faith? Let the dead bury the dead. Let ignorance reproduce itself until it's weary of its own offspring. This is between you and me. You can no longer resist my spirit without suffering pain. Come back. All is forgiven. And she was sitting there sobbing. They, of course, didn't air that part, but that's what I would say. I think that's what God would say, actually, because it certainly didn't come from me.
But just in case this is giving the impression that the Mind Renewed is all about homing in on the negative things in this world, let me also mention some of the more obviously uplifting conversations. I mean, it's been great, for example, to have spoken with so many fellow Christians on subjects as diverse as science and faith with Professor Edgar Andrews, intelligent design with Dr. Michael Behe, and even politics, music and art with the singer and performance artist J.J. Jones, whose music begins and ends this program. And let me just say that that music from J.J. Jones comes off his album 12 Minutes of Christmas, and I've put a link in the show notes so that you can get hold of a copy of that, and I do highly recommend that album. And I want to play just a second section from my interview with J.J. Jones, because as we've been talking about the issue of world government, which I guess has got to be the statist's dream of how the world will supposedly work in the best possible way if everything's controlled from the centre right across the globe, J.J. Jones offers a vision of how he thinks things ought to be that I think is much, much more attractive, and that's moving very much in the opposite direction.
It's funny because I have been telling people recently I'm a local socialist, a national libertarian, and an international anarchist. Probably more like a minarchist, but
Could you explain all those terms?
Well, you know, locally speaking, if you've got a small, you know, in your city or in your county or even in your state, when I'm speaking of the United States, of course, but in your region, right? Of course, you want to do whatever you can to take care of everybody, which is a completely socialistic kind of a mindset. And any rational person would want that to be true. And of course, there are going to be people who, you know, would rather teach a man to fish than give him the fish. And, you know, some people you need to teach and some people you need to give, depending on the time. But in a small, in a smaller regional kind of way, I think it's much easier to have an overview of that and to control it. But the higher you go, the farther removed the people making the decisions are, and the more power they have. And then on the national level, it's crazy. I mean, you've got an army and an IRS forcing people to pay taxes, and then they do these crazy things with the money, like war and a bunch of other stuff that benefits the rich. I have nothing against the rich, but, you know, as long as they earn their money, but they shouldn't be given government handouts. The farther removed you are, it's much easier for the national government of the United States to create a welfare state and to say, oh, look, we're helping people. But then what they end up doing is trapping these people in the welfare state. But they can't feel it because they're too far away or they're too far removed. So locally, I'm totally into socialism. Let's help everybody and let's share the wealth and let's be good Christians. On a national level, you've got to reduce the power that's in those hands, absolutely. And certainly a world government, we're nowhere near being ready for a world government. I can't even believe that people even talk about it. I mean, look how different all of the continents are. How could you ever have a world government? It's so counterintuitive that it's mind-boggling.
And one of the key things about the Mind Renewed is that it is very much Christian-based. In fact, increasingly I'm seeing it as a Christian ministry, in that we are attempting to understand what's going on around us in the world from a Christian worldview perspective. But that doesn't mean that it's just for Christians. I mean, most emphatically, I've wanted the Mind Renewed to be a kind of meeting place for the sharing of information between people of all kinds of beliefs, where we can discuss with mutual respect. And I think that it's achieved that, which I think is very, very pleasing. At least that's how it seems to me. But having said that, it is a Christian ministry. And one of the things which really sticks in my mind from the interviews this year is the testimony that Dr. Martin Erdmann gave in his third interview with us. We were talking about technocracy and saying that the fundamental reason why such a system could never succeed is because, as with all utopian systems, it would need perfect human beings to make it work. And, you know, you're never going to get a world of perfect human beings. But from a Christian perspective, of course, there is God's promise to everyone who believes in Christ that they shall one day be made perfect through the power of God. But most emphatically, not in this age, not in this present cosmic order, but in the age to come, when the world shall be transformed. Certainly not by human ingenuity with all its technocracies and its transhumanisms, but precisely by the power of God when Christ returns, and as the book of Revelation puts it, when God makes all things new. And it was in that context that Dr. Erdmann shared his testimony with us.
Well, you are once again perfectly correct in noting that the new man needs to be created. The question still remains, how? How can a new person be created? How can his thinking be changed so that obviously a utopian system could work? As a matter of fact, there's only one clear answer to this. It will not work unless you commit yourself to Jesus Christ, because he promised in the scriptures that he will make a person new. I just remind you of one passage which just comes to my mind. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17, I would like to quote it to you. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creature. The old things passed away. behold, new things have come. And then verse 18, now all these things are from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. So the Bible is very clear on this point. There is only one chance how human beings can change, and that change needs to be brought about by God himself. And the way how he does it is by giving us the opportunity to believe in his son, Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ died on the cross for the sins of human beings. And he offers us full forgiveness of whatever sin we committed. And if we receive his forgiveness by faith, we also know that we will have eternal life. So the hope which the gospel presents to us goes beyond this earthly existence. It includes all eternity. So this is really the only hope which we can offer to anyone who wants to change his life. And it's not our offer, it's the offer of the Almighty God. All these utopian ideas which human beings have come up with over the centuries, including transhumanism, including technocracy, including socialism, all these utopian ideas cannot be brought about. The only way how we can become new creatures is by believing in Jesus Christ. As a matter of fact, I experienced it in my own life. When I turned about 18, I came to faith in Jesus Christ. And I can say, I can testify from 1 second to the next, my life had wonderfully changed. And from that moment onward, I knew I had eternal life. I knew my sins were forgiven. And this is really the gospel message, that anyone who believes in Jesus Christ can experience the same new life, which transcends this earthly existence.
Well, we're almost at the end of this whistle-stop tour through the archives of the Mind Renewed. I haven't, of course, been able to include every interview. There are loads more that I'd like to have included, but obviously I've had to limit myself in what I'm doing here. But just before we close, I'd like to mention a comment by a listener. Now, indeed, I'm very grateful for all the messages of encouragement and support that have come in, but I want to mention one in particular, not because it's the one that I value more than any other, but because it illustrates the kind of message that has been particularly helpful to me in showing that the Mind Renewed is achieving at least some of what it set out to do. And it comes from Irene, who says, "Hi, I would like to thank you for your excellent broadcasts. They have been a great source of information and provide a sort of relief and comfort to hear reasonable arguments and thorough observations of the current goings-on in this world with a Christian viewpoint." And then she ends like this: "Many thanks for your work and others you invite on board. God bless you and your endeavours, Irene." And if you're listening, Irene, I want to thank you particularly for sending that message, because those are precisely two of the main things that I've hoped for the Mind Renewed, that it should be seen as dealing with subjects in a reasonable and non-sensationalist manner. And even more important, that it should be, as you say, that it should provide a kind of relief, because right from the start, that was one of the main things that I was concerned to do. And I know what a relief it's been for me when I've seen something, say, in the mainstream media that just doesn't make sense. And I think I'm being lied to here. And then I've heard somebody, most probably on the alternative media, say that they don't believe it either. And they've given good reasons for that. And I found that, precisely as you say, a sort of relief, a comfort. So I'm absolutely delighted that you and others have found that to be true of the Mind Renewed. That in itself makes it worthwhile doing. That makes it worthwhile spending all these hours putting these things together. So I thank you. And I thank you again, all of you who've sent in messages over the last year. So we've come to the end. This is the last, as it were, official production of the Mind Renewed until the new year. I do, however, expect to be putting up a couple of extra podcasts over the Christmas fortnight, as anybody who listens to this regularly will know I like to do. So please do check back at the end of each week for those. But the next official podcast will be in early January, and that will be an interview with Tom Secker on the subject of the 7/7 London bombings. Please also check out the message tab during Christmas. By the way, it's moved. It's moved to the first level, so it's been upgraded. I will be updating information about upcoming shows on there. And by the way, if you see a guest on that list who you think, yeah, I'd really like to ask them a question, then please do let me know what that question is. And if it's appropriate, I'll see if I can fit it into the interview. So that's the message tab. So once again, thanks to all of you for your messages, your suggestions, your shares, your comments on blogs, the offers of support, comments on iTunes. Although I have to say, we could really do with some more comments on iTunes. I don't know how many people listen to The Mind Renewed through iTunes, but if you do, please do consider adding a comment there. Thanks also to Leon Petard for inviting me onto Fair Dinkum Radio, and to Tim Kelkenny and Chris White for welcoming now The Mind Renewed onto Revelations Radio Network, and to Dr. Martin Erdman for such great moral support since the very beginning of The Mind Renewed. And most of all, to all of you for listening, because without you, The Mind Renewed simply would not continue to exist. So thank you for sharing this journey with me, however long you have been on this journey with me. It's been an amazing year. So I wish you all a very blessed Christmas, and the predictions for 2014 notwithstanding, I also wish you a very happy new year. And we'll end with one of the highlights of the year, certainly one of the highlights for me, when at the end of the second interview with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, I facetiously asked him if Osama bin Laden might get caught again. And you know what he's like? With his unique combination of intelligence and wit, well, I think he summed it all up brilliantly. At the end of your article, you describe Osama bin Laden as the man who died twice, which is what I thought I would call this podcast, actually. So I want to ask you if you think there's a chance that they might actually try to get him a third time.
Well, I don't think they can pull that off.
Are you sure?
I don't even think the American media would fall for that. What could you say? You could say, oh, yes, we didn't bury him. We brought his body back secretly. So we could resurrect it. We went to Area 51 where the aliens landed, and we have their machine for restoring bodies to life, and it worked, and we have him back now. But he escaped.
Long time ago in Bethlehem, the Holy Bible say, Mary's boy child, Jesus Christ, was born on Christmas Day. Hark now, hear the angels sing, the new King's born today. And man will live forevermore because of Christmas Day. While shepherds watched their flocks by night, they saw a bright new shining star, and heard a choir from heaven sing. The music came from afar. Hark now, hear the angels sing, new King's born today. And man will live forevermore because of Christmas Day. Now Joseph and his wife Mary came to Bethlehem that night. They found no place to bear her child, not a single room was in sight. By and by they found a little nook in a stable all forlorn. And in the manger, cold and dark, Mary's little boy child was born. Trumpets sound and angels sing, listen to what they say, that man will live forevermore because of Christmas Day.